Today on The Grave Talks, The Darkest Cases, a conversation with Jimmy Pettinito. Jimmy Pettinito has been on the paranormal investigation scene longer than most. Originally part of the investigative team put together by Ed and Lorraine Warren, Jimmy has walked through the doors of some of America's most infamous haunts and has seen firsthand the true power of the paranormal. Throughout his career, Jimmy has been a part of more than 50 exorcisms, including prolific exorcisms performed by Father Malachi Martin. Today, we talk about the life that Jimmy has found himself in and the dark cases he's investigated over his career.
Ever since I was a kid, I was interested in the paranormal, supernatural, whatever we called it back then. I would watch back when I was a kid, they only had shows like In Search Of, Unsolved Mysteries, that sort of thing. Yep. And I would watch any show I could on that subject matter. As a kid, I collected all, you know, any kind of ghost books or ghost photography books, UFO books. I couldn't get enough of that stuff. And one particular episode of In Search Of, Hans Holzer was the main speaker in it, and he was saying that you could communicate with spirits anywhere. It doesn't have to be in a haunted location. You could find them in your own house. So I was like 6 years old or something, and he goes, you know, you could find them in your basement. So I immediately asked my mom, we got a flashlight? She's like, yeah. And I remember the one I got, it had a little red light on it. I was all excited, and I went down the basement, and she goes, what are you doing? I said, I'll go look for ghosts in the basement. And I was so aggravated, I didn't find any. But I was always interested since I was a little kid.
Sure.
And I had one incident. I was about 9 or 10 years old. It seems like the age where most people have an experience. My mother was having company over in the kitchen. And it was about 7 o'clock at night. And she said, Jimmy, stay up in your room. You know, I'm having company. Don't bother us, basically. Sure. Stay up in your room. So I went up in my room. I remember I was laying on my stomach on the bed, with my knees bent in the air, my feet dangling over my back, kind of. And I was listening to a baseball game on the radio, and it was the old radios with the two dials, one for volume, one for tuning. And all of a sudden, the radio started changing stations. And even as a young kid, I thought, oh, it must be some kind of weird defect or frequency. I don't know. I didn't jump to ghost, you know? So I look over at the radio, and I could actually see the tuning knob, which was huge, like, you know, three, it was a big knob, turning back and forth. So then I started freaking out, and then something slammed my legs that were over my back down onto the bed really, really hard. And I ran downstairs, like my mother told me not to. Said, Ma, there's a ghost in my room. I was changing my radio stations. I threw my legs down on the bed. There's a ghost in my room. And she said, Jimmy, get back up in your bed. There's no such thing as ghosts. And I said, I think now I'm still trying to prove her wrong. Tony.
Yeah. It was an experience that was very compelling. I mean, you're seeing things being manipulated that otherwise could not turn on their own. And I think we should preface that for anyone who, you know, was not alive in the days of Unsolved Mysteries and everything's been digital for them. It's, you know, that you didn't, there was no digital component. There was no way, there was nothing that would make this happen on its own. There's no explanation for something like that when it's physically being manipulated. And then you had that physical interaction, that physical feeling as well. That would lead one to believe, yes, there's something going on here in that house. Was that your only experience in that house, or did other experiences continue to progress throughout your childhood?
Well, that's the weird thing. I wouldn't consider that I lived in a haunted house. That was just the only incident that ever happened in that house.
Wow.
And but it kind of piqued my curiosity even more. When I got a little older, I remember I got a book, I think it was called Real Ghosts, by Daniel Cohen. I don't know how I remember that. But there was a picture of the Brown Lady of Raynham Hall in it.
Yeah.
If you're familiar with that picture, the lady on top of the staircase.
Very famous.
And they called it a spirit photography. And I said, I want to get a picture like that one day. I still haven't got a picture. I still haven't gotten a picture that good. But I started before the internet. I couldn't really find, you know, haunted locations to go to. I didn't know where they were.
Sure.
So I would just go to local cemeteries, taking pictures, trying to get stuff. And finally, a friend of mine told me where, how to get to Union Cemetery in Easton, Connecticut, home of the white lady who I've heard of that story. So it's a woman in white that supposedly walks through the cemetery. And I was under understanding that you could just go to the cemetery and take her picture. Mm-hmm. Like she's walking around, you just get her picture. So I went there one night with, a roll of film, and I waited 2 hours. I didn't see the white lady. So I said, I'm just going to, take my roll of film and go home. And that could have been the end of my little ghost hunting career. But then when I got home, I got them developed, and I got some weird, not a little orb or something. I got some really solid looking stuff on there. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I was curious. So that's kind of weird. So I went back over and over and over again. And I had I made a photo album of all the pictures I got. And I would go up there, and once in a while you see another person taking pictures up there and you start talking with them. So I met a girl named Debbie up there who I was trying to show people my book. Like, look at me. And she was looking through them. She goes, oh, the Warrens would love to see these pictures. She goes, she's a member of their group, Ed and Lorraine Warren. Mm-hmm. So she says they have meetings on Monday night. She goes, why don't you come next Monday night and show them your pictures? So the next Monday night I went, and I didn't know of them because they came to my college probably a year before or so, and I was familiar with them. And I remember going up there, and I said, I got to make sure, because these pictures are so good that they're going to want to steal them and take them for their own. And then when I got up there, I showed Lorraine the pictures. She goes, can we have these? I was like, sure, take them. And since then, I started working with the group.
And when you started having those interactions, we should paint the picture here too. This is pre-television shows about ghosts on any sort of mass scale. Exactly what you said. There was unsolved mysteries and the handful that existed, but they were few and far between. And there wasn't the culture that there is today in terms of people being interested in the paranormal or as openly discussed. I mean, it had to have been, you're kind of putting yourself out on a limb there, going around with your book of
yeah.
pictures that you found without everybody going, well, there's the crazy kid that's got
that's the way it was back then. When we investigate a home, mm-hmm. Suppose we're coming back at 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and it was kind of a tradition that we go to this diner close to their house after a case and get something to eat.
Yeah.
And they were locally famous then. Sure. It wasn't like Conjuring famous now, but people knew who they were. And I remember we'd be sitting there, like a group of us, and there would people be whispering and pointing and kind of like making fun, like those are those weirdos that do that stuff. And I said, nowadays, people would be begging for their autographs.
Yeah, exactly. It was a completely different dynamic. I'm friends with Chris McKinnell, and he's been on our show several times. I help him with a lot of he's getting his own podcast going and his website. So I've been helping him put all that up in the air. And obviously, just the investigations, the stories and all that at that time, different place and time. So how did that work? How was that for you when you connected with the Warrens and you began getting involved with the group and going out on investigations? How did that progress over time? What was the process of going out on a ghost investigation with the Warrens at that point in time?
Right. Well, at the in the beginning, we mostly have a class, and like I said, it was on Monday nights. And one of the first things we do is review. They'd get numerous messages on their answering machine every week of people wanting their house investigated. Mm-hmm. And they'd play all the messages for us. So, we get this one in New York, this one in New Jersey, this one in Connecticut. And we pick through them and see which ones were needed the help first, maybe with a child or something violent. And that's why a lot of people kind of question the Warrens' cases, like, how come all their cases are crazy, demonic, or, because they were the only people doing this at the time.
Sure.
And they were picking the worst of the worst. They're not picking, I heard 3 knocks on my door and that's it. They're not going there. They're going to the house with somebody getting slashed every day, Mm-hmm. So most classes they used to be instructional, like how to conduct an investigation or how to what questions to ask a client. What cases came in or the week, what they're working on now. And then even sometimes, we'd have a 2-hour class and then visit 3 homes after the class. So we'd go, you know, travel over the state, just getting an initial interview from people. And we usually go in a group. So it's never, it wasn't for a while. So they'll send you out on your own. Mm-hmm. So, the first time I went up there, I went with my friend Rick Clark, who we kind of created a team. Anytime they'd have a case, that they'd send us on together. So the first case we ever, they sent us on just by ourselves, was a house in Waterbury, Connecticut. And Lorraine called us up. It was, I don't know, 9-10 o'clock at night. And she says, hey, do you guys want to go to a house in Waterbury, Connecticut? The woman is sitting on her front steps crying, and she will not go back in the house till somebody gets there. So that's like your dream come true. I mean, you don't want the person to be crying, but it was exciting. It's sure. Like, yeah, we're going. We're going on our first case together, alone. And the woman, we went, and the woman was crying on her front steps when we got there.
What's going through your mind as you're about to enter into this, your first case? Obviously, you know, the acceptance that this stuff happens, I'm sure, is there. But then to experience it firsthand, or what you're walking into after hearing and seeing the stories that Ed and Lorraine have been preparing you for, what do you think you're about to walk into?
Well, you know, what's funny is we didn't know we were walking into. She literally didn't give us too much. It was so long ago. She might have told us something, but we didn't know any much details about the case, except that the woman's crying and won't go inside her house. Mm-hmm. So we got up there, and our the first thing we want to do is interview the woman. And she was very young. She was maybe 22 years old, and she had a 3-year-old son. She had a boyfriend that worked nights, and they were the only people that lived in the it was a second floor apartment. And so we set up, back then we only had a video camera, a still camera, and an old EMF meter. Like that was I was a tech expert for having that stuff. Mm-hmm. Back then, that's all we had. So we set up in the living room, and we wanted to get her story first. So we could, our job back then was more to observe and report. It was kind of nice because there was no pressure on us. It was to get the story and then give it to the Warrens to see what they want to do with it. So I remember the woman was telling us that, that she's been bothered by a shadow figure. Her 3-year-old son's been scratched and beaten by some little, the boy says it's a little boy that does it named Bobby. And she said one time she went to the boy's bedroom, and every toy that was in his toy box and in his closet was piled on top of him. Like just something impossible to, he couldn't do it himself.
Sure.
He had these little blinking sneakers. You know those little sneakers that light up?
Sure, yeah.
He had those, and there's a funny story about those. The woman's mother would come visit her a lot because she used to be terrified, and the boyfriend was out working at night, so she'd come visit a lot. And the mother told us that the pair of sneakers, they're sitting on the little boy's room. She goes, "Those sneakers right there." She goes, "They mock me." And I said, "What are you talking about? They mock you?" She goes, "Well, I'll walk by, and they'll blink at me." I said, "Well, maybe it's the vibration of the ground or something, or the battery. I don't know how they work. You know, the batteries are going."
Sure.
And she goes, "No." She goes, "I've actually seen them walk across the room. Sneakers." Maybe we'll come back to that part later, but yeah, that's important. So, what else? She sees, and while we're talking to her, she's terrified. She'd point to a certain corner of the room and says, "Don't you see it right there?" I was like, "See what?" She goes, "There's a shadow man right there." And it's like, "We don't see it." Mm-hmm. Me or Rick don't see it. So we're a half hour into this. I said, maybe she's just imagining things.
Yeah.
We're not seeing anything. And I'm literally ready to pack up my stuff. And then she says, she goes, "Oh, it just went into the bedroom." So I really don't believe her at this point. I mean, I'm older now and more experienced. I'd probably, you know, stick with it more. But back then, I was like, we're not seeing anything.
Sure.
So she goes, "Okay, it went into the bedroom." So me and Rick and her, we go into the bedroom, and she goes, "There it is. Don't you see it right there?" And like me and Rick are looking at each other like, "Do you see that?" And he's like, "Yeah." "Do you see it?" "Yes." So it literally just looked like a shadow outside of a wall, definitely like a man's figure. He's in the corner of the room, and he's just standing there. And because I didn't believe them, I made a mistake of not bringing a camera or the video camera into the bedroom. So we're just by ourselves looking at this shadow, and it was literally only 6 to 8 feet away from us. So I say to Rick, I said, "Should I go back and get the camera and risk never seeing this again, or, you know, try to document this thing?" Mm-hmm. So he goes, let's try to touch it. So we took like 2 steps forward, and as we were walking, the thing turned towards the wall, took a step, and disappeared. I don't know if it disappeared into the wall or just on its own. Mm-hmm. But then I remember I ran around the hallway to see if he came out the other side of the wall, but there was nothing there. So that was the first time I ever saw anything like that.
When you're in a case like that, and you're obviously hindsight is 20/20 now, and having more experience, it makes you think, well, maybe I would have done this, would have done that.
Yeah.
And then just kind of understanding what is going on. How did that case progress? Because I have some questions about what your opinion is on the why these things happen like this, where it's a dark shadow. It seems to be, like the woman said, mocking her with the shoes walking around. Yeah. Was there any more evidence that was found on that case, or any sort of conclusion?
Well, I'm trying to think if there's a... We didn't really find the you know, the reason for the haunting or mm-hmm. or what it was, but they were so terrified. There was so much stuff happening in the house. They rented month to month. So I remember they had about a week or two left in their lease, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And they basically moved everything out of the house. Mm-hmm. And they said, you guys are free to do experiments or try to see what you can find here. So I remember, and they even had the power off. Mm-hmm. So there was no, you know, it was dark and really quiet.
Yeah.
And one day me and the woman were talking in the hallway, like really close face to face because we couldn't see. And we're just talking about something like maybe, you know, like, hey, you go in this room, I'll go in there. But we're just talking. And all of a sudden you hear, hey, you, like that out of nowhere. That's the first time I ever heard a voice out of nowhere. We call it a disembodied voice. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that was.
At that point in time, when you're going in to investigate this house, and you had received the training that you did from Ed and Lorraine, what is the end goal when going to someone's home? Is it to simply document and show that, yes, in fact, something is happening here, more than just what the homeowner is saying? Is it to eradicate what's going on there and help them find peace? What is the purpose at that point in time?
Yeah, our purpose was to observe and report, and then report back to Ed and Lorraine. So after that first night, actually, I got a glad you reminded me of that, because it reminded me of a story. The first night we went there, we actually wrote up a report, and I took the shoes. I want these sneakers out of my house. Mm-hmm. So we went back the next night, and I left the report and the sneakers on top of our television at home. And it was around Halloween. So my wife, it's like 1 o'clock in the morning, she's watching scary movies. And we had, back then, we used to decorate crazy for Halloween. Like, we had these hanging, like a vampire, a ghost. Our front mat, if you step on it, it says Happy Halloween and laughs hysterically. So that's upsetting the scene for you. Mm-hmm. So she was watching scary movies. We were at the house again. And she said, I was watching the scary movies, and all of a sudden my eyes catch the sneakers on top of the TV. That was back in the olden days. We had big wooden TVs, people. And so she goes, her eyes caught the sneakers, and saying, what are those sneakers doing there? And then she saw the report underneath the sneakers. So she goes back to the couch and she starts reading the report. And it, you know, explains what the sneakers are doing there, and that they were seen blinking at different times, at odd times. They're seen walking across the room. So she looks up at the sneakers and they start blinking at her. And then she says, every decoration in our house started going. These are all like motion things. They'd be clap, they'll go off. So she goes, all the decorations started going off. The front mat was saying Happy Halloween, laughing. She threw the sneakers out the front door. And the next morning when I came home, maybe 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, I got home and I saw the sneakers there. I'm like, oh boy, I'm in trouble. And she goes, never again. You're going anywhere overnight. And so, yeah, our job was to observe and report and record any evidence we could. And it was for two reasons. It was to document. We wanted to document stuff to show that this stuff happens, of course.
Sure.
And then hopefully have a final result of getting the thing out of the house and helping the people out. But these people are already, they're already moving out. In the process of moving out. So we did go there even after the investigation. We had a priest come and bless the home, because the guy that owned the house, it was a three family, the guy that owned the house said he wanted to do it anyway for the next tenants. And it was kind of weird because the priest that did it put St. Benedict medals and he nailed them all up in all the closets and, you know, all around the house, but they're kind of like they weren't in an obvious spot. They'd be like on the inside wall of a closet. You'd have to actually go in there to find them. Mm-hmm. So I said, imagine the next tenants to go in there and find all these all over the place. What are they going to think?
Like, why did these go up here in this house? Yeah.
A funny story about that house was I had a, somehow I figured out that one of my friends at work, a friend of theirs lived on one of the other floors. And they said, oh, I remember when those Ghostbusters were up there making a racket, running around at night when we're trying to sleep. And he goes, oh, that was my friend. So we found out later. I said, hey, could you find out if the next people have any problems or, you know, do they have any stories of stuff going on? Oh, I forgot a big major thing, Tony.
Yeah.
The mother would cook. She'd bake cookies or brownies or muffins. Mm-hmm. For the family, and she put them on top of the refrigerator in the back, so they aren't visible for the three old kid can't see them because sure. He'd want to eat them. So every so often, like she'd go out shopping or whatever, and then she'd come home and she said, I want to go get the muffins off the refrigerator, and they weren't there. Like the dish was still there, but the muffins are missing. So she didn't understand what's going on.
Yeah.
So one day the little boy, she found in the closet. She found a stack of muffins in the closet, all stacked up. And she didn't understand why that happened.
Yeah.
And then another time, she had friends over in the kitchen, and the little boy came out, and he was, like, terrified. You know, she goes, what's wrong? What's wrong? And he goes, come in here. And he pointed behind the couch, and all the cookies were stacked up behind the couch in the living room. Mm-hmm. So that's important to know for this part. So we said, could you ask the current tenants if they have any problems? And the guy says, yeah, matter of fact, because he smokes cigarettes and he keeps packs of cigarettes in his refrigerator. And she goes, he comes home and the cigarettes are missing. So I imagine he found them later, you know, stacked somewhere in the house.
When you have patterns like that, the stacking of things, that's obviously something that gets portrayed in Ghostbusters and in some other places as well. Is there some story to that of the stacking where people will find their objects stacked in very bizarre ways in bizarre places?
You know, I just found out recently that was a thing, like the stacking of things.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't research it well, but I just found out recently that's a thing that happens. It's common that people find things stacked.
I'm just wondering why is this a ongoing occurrence or a regular occurrence or a theme that seems to happen with objects that seem to go missing and then are found in other locations in that way. Go ahead.
No, it's a good idea for a future show.
Yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon. As you continued on your investigating and getting out there into the world of the paranormal with the society there with Ed and Lorraine, and obviously you're running into cases where there's shadow people, there's seemingly apparitions, sometimes there's things where it may be a loved one, and it's not malevolent, it's not super dark, it's just kind of freaky and weird and obviously unsettling. Things I know you ended up falling into some cases where things were going more towards the dark side. What was that for you? What was one of the first times that you were working a case where you were looking at this going, I don't know that this is, you know, Uncle Jimmy that's hanging out here. This feels like there's something else going on.
I got a good story for you then. One of the cases we worked on, this was from Meriden, Connecticut. And it was another three family houses. These three family houses are trouble. This family lived on the first floor. It was a mom, dad, a 14-year-old son, and a little girl. And we got sent there to get their story. And his main complaint was the cable box was talking to him. And I'm like, what do you mean the cable box is talking to you? So he told us a story how I think it was a Friday night, his the whole family was watching Seinfeld, and the cable box, this is back in the olden days when they had just the cable box went from 0 to 78 or something like that.
Sure.
And the cable just started changing stations on its own. It'll just flip through random stations. So I said, okay, there's something wrong with the cable. They went to sleep. Next day, same time, the cable box starts flipping out again. Now they have family in Florida where the it's their nephew, and he was about the same age as the 14-year-old boy, and he committed suicide like only a week earlier. So one of the, I think it was the mother said, maybe it's cousin or whoever trying to communicate with us. So immediately the TV started frantically changing stations now, going from 0 to 77 over and over again. I think it was the son that said, why don't we say that channel 1 is A and channel 26 is Z? Mm-hmm. So as soon as he said that, it went to 25, 5, then 19, which in that code spells yes. So for the next hour or so, the dad got a note paper out, and they were asking questions to the TV, and he would write the question down and then write all the channels it went to and then decipher it later, see if it made sense. So it told this big long story how this man, he called himself Joe Dana, was murdered in their apartment 10 years earlier. His murderers were never caught. He's not at peace. He's buried down the street somewhere. It gave a social security number. And so after this happened, for example, when this is really weird, the dad was 44 years old at the time, and when you walk into the room, the cable box would go to channel 44, and they understood that to say it's saying hi to the dad. They had parties where they'd have neighbors and friends come over, and they'd stand in a room to the side, and they'd walk in one by one and would greet everybody by their age. It knew everybody's age, and then when you leave the room, it would flash 3 times your age saying goodbye. So this happened for a while. They actually had Joe parties. So they kind of, after a while, the dad felt bad for the spirit. He goes, can I help you in any way? And it spelled out, I want a Christian burial. And he wants his murder to be solved. Mm-hmm. So they actually called the police, and they came out and took the report. And of course they thought the guy was nuts, but the cable box gave, I believe it gave the police officer's home phone number, his children's names, his social security number, all stuff that it was before Google. The cable box knew everything about this cop that came out.
And there's no way to program your cable box to do that. Yeah.
No. And then there was all these cases. There's always people saying it's a hoax. Like his sergeant was a non-believer totally. And he came and he goes, well, it's probably that they thought the 14-year-old son had another remote under the blanket and was doing this. It was like you said, how does he know all this information about everybody? Mm-hmm. And it was giving that guy the non-believer information about his life. So they took a report. They researched the man's social security number and his name. There was no person by that name ever listed missing. The social security number never existed. And now they have a new mystery. Who are we talking to?
Yeah.
Who we've been talking to all this time. So after a while, it seemed like it didn't need the cable box anymore. Like it was kind of like in the house now. It didn't need that to communicate. They were getting knockings, whisperings in their ear when they're going to sleep, terrified, electronics acting up. And let's see what happened next. We went back there quite a few times to try to capture evidence. I remember one day I was in the boy's bedroom, and it's really we had a hall light on, so it wasn't pitch black, and you could almost see like black shapes in the bedroom, like just floating around like mists, swirls, mm-hmm. and stuff.
Sure.
And I was trying to capture it with my video camera. So the 14-year-old boy comes running in and pulls up his shirt, and he has this big burn mark on his stomach, like a perfect circle almost. And I was like, what happened? And he said, he was this 3 foot tall muscle dude with pointed ears was standing in front of me and put his head down and charged into my stomach and then disappeared. He goes, this is what I have on my stomach. Crazy stuff.
Yeah.
So we'd go back and report this to Ed and Lorraine, you know, every time we went. And then it was 1 week where they said, we've come here quite a few times. We haven't gotten any help yet. There was one, the priest in their local diocese wouldn't even come out to bless their house. I remember that. So I said, you know, we could do a little house blessing for you until, you know, you get some help. So I think it was a Sunday night. And me and my friend went there, and we're going to do a blessing on their house.
Sure.
And like I said, the cable box wasn't communicating anymore. But the owner told us the day that we were going to go there, it communicated one last time. It said, look out tonight. It's spelled out. So we go there. We're setting up our stuff. And the dad had the Bible on cassette tape. And it was like that big giant clamshell case with, you know, 30 tapes in it.
Sure.
And he said, do you mind if I play this while you're doing your thing? And I said, whatever you want, it's your house, do what you want. So he goes, which one do you want to hear? I said, I'm not any kind of expert or anything on the Bible. I said, just put tape one in. So he puts tape one in, and remember those big systems with the big giant speakers and the tape player and the record player in it?
Sure.
He put that in there. And as soon as he plays play, it starts playing backwards. And you know how anything played backwards sounds creepy, but the Bible backwards is really creepy?
Yeah.
I have that on video, too. It's really creepy. Anyway, so I said, take that one out of there. And then we tried other ones, and that's the only one that doesn't play correctly. And what's funny is I had a case years after that from a sound engineer. If I tell you all the people, it gives it away. But he worked with major artists. Mm-hmm. Def Leppard, AC/DC, and I worked on his house, and I became friends with him. So after a while, I said, "Hey, I got this tape that plays backwards." And I said, "I don't know if there's something wrong. I'd rather know if there's something wrong with something. I'd rather know than telling some story about it that's not true." You know?
Yeah.
I said, "I'm gonna bring this to you and see if you can find anything wrong with it." So I brought it to his house, and I don't know what he did with it. He put it through a system, whatever, anything. He said, there's nothing wrong with this tape. Get it out of my house. Don't come over here anymore. So I still have that tape now. And so after that night, I wanted to call them the next day to see how everything was better, worse. You know, sometimes when you do these things to a house, they could go away or they get worse because they're angry. You don't know. So I went to call them the next day and see how everything was. And they didn't answer the phone. I called them every day for days and nobody answered the phone. And then I finally drove over there and they're just totally gone. So I don't know what happened.
Almost as if they were just driven out and couldn't handle it anymore. I want to ask you about that tape. So if I'm understanding correctly, when you were going through this, you would put it into the player and the audio that was coming out was in reverse, just as if the tape was playing in reverse. Is that what's on the tape? Is the audio in reverse on the tape?
According to the guy, it shouldn't be playing like that. The sound engineer expert guy.
So
but it was the Bible playing backwards, was going in the right direction. But I know sometimes tapes get twisted and everybody's had that happen. But he says there's nothing wrong with the tape. Get it out of my house.
That wraps up part one of our conversation with Jimmy Pettinino. If you'd like to hear the rest of our conversation in part two, please become a Gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our program. You can do it at patreon.com/thegravetalks. We'll ask, how did the story of the dark figure in the home with the cable box that could communicate conclude? And what kind of demonic ritual was tied to that haunting after all? What happens if Jimmy plays the cassette, that infamous cassette with the Bible verses on today? Will it still play in reverse? What has shocked Jimmy most about what has happened during an exorcism? And having been part of more than 50 exorcisms over his career, has Jimmy ever feared for his own safety? Can a person be possessed by something other than a demon? We'll discuss all of this and more in part two of our conversation. To hear it, like I said, become a Gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our program. Go to patreon.com/thegravetalks, and you will have access to part one and part two of this episode. You'll also have access to all of our bonus episodes and advanced episodes months before they're released to the public, all commercial free. Go to thegravetalks.com, click Become a Gravekeeper, or directly at patreon.com/thegravetalks. That's what supports our program and allows us to stay on the air. Until next time for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.